What's up, everybody? Welcome to episode number 6 of Arc Junkies. I am your host, Jimmy McKnight. It is Monday, October 2nd, 2017. The road to FabTech has begun. You've seen me blowing this up on Instagram. The day has arrived. We are here. Adam Janai is my guest on this week's episode of Arc Junkies. Adam Janai is the founder of Mob Steel. He is also the founder of Detroit Steel Wheel Co. You can see him on History Channel's Detroit Steel. The guy is an industry leader in his profession and an absolute awesome dude to top it all off, as you will hear in this episode. But before we get into this episode, I need to tell you about our sponsors, Weld Devils. Go to www.welddevils.com right now for welder-inspired gear like hats, t-shirts, coffee mugs, plus a growing online community unlike any other. Welddevils.com. We are devils. Moving on, I got an email this week from a listener named Keith Baker. Keith says, "I'm happy I found your podcast. I like the guests you have and the rock and roll vibe of the show. Thank you for not talking for an hour and a half either, as that can get boring at times. Don't get me wrong, I like the other podcasts, but it gets stretched out a little too long in my opinion. I would like to hear opinions on tungsten stickout, as the subject is never really talked about. Have a great week at work. Thank you." Well, first off, thank you, Keith, for taking the time to email the show. I really do appreciate it. And as far as tungsten stickout goes, to me, tungsten stickout really, it's a varying answer. It's something that depends on the type of material that you're welding. It depends on the type of weld that you're doing. Collet body versus gas lens. I mean, all of those factors really take precedence. And when you're talking about tungsten stickout, personally for me, and it is all, you know, what feels best for you. Rule of thumb for me, I have my tungsten personally stick out about a quarter of an inch, just depending on what I'm doing. If I'm using like a size 5 or size 6 cup, I usually sharpen my tungsten on a 25 degree angle and it sticks out, I want to say, about a quarter of an inch. Now, if I'm welding on aluminum with, and it also depends on the type of tungsten that you're using. If you're using a multi-mix to weld aluminum, it usually tends to hold the point, versus if you're using, green tungsten or pure tungsten, if you will, it depends. It tends to ball up, and then you're going to need to stick it out a little more to compensate for the balling up of the pure tungsten. So to give you a definitive answer for me, I'd say the good rule of thumb is about a quarter of an inch, depending on, again, the type of base metal that you're using and the type of tungsten that you're using. And then walking the cup, obviously, it's a whole new set of guidelines for that. So I hope that answers your question. If not, and someone out there has a better answer, please send an email to arcjunkies@gmail.com and I will read it on the air as I'm reading Keith's, and we'll get this figured out and see what you guys have to say. I think, you know, like I said, I think it varies. I think it's a varying answer. You know, there's not one definitive answer. There's a good rule of thumb. You know, online they say don't have your tungsten stick out longer than the diameter, inside diameter of the cup that you're using. But again, collet body versus gas lens, that's quite a major difference. So we'll put a fork in this and get into it later. Let's get on with the show and our guest this week, Adam Janai. Congratulations on all the success you've had with Mob Steel, with the show Detroit Steel. Where we left off on Detroit Steel, you had the grand opening of your showroom. Mm-hmm. What has been going on with Mob Steel since then?
Well, the grand opening, we had that, you know, essentially on the History Channel. But mm-hmm. That we've actually been in that shop for about 3 years. Mm-hmm. So it's a new deal for us. You know, we're working vertically. We're used to being spread out. But it's been a lot of fun. So it really took 3 years to renovate each floor, figuring out how the workflow is going to work. Mm-hmm. But we actually had the wheel business in there first. So while we were filming, we said, okay, when we're done filming with NBC, we're going to fold this up, get everything moved. We're rocking and rolling all under one roof. We've done a lot of growing, so we were trying to get everything consolidated. We had two buildings at one time and then three, and trying to get it down to the one downtown location. Mm-hmm. But, then we got approached by History Channel. And, you know, it was something we decided we didn't really want to do again, but they made us a great offer. It gave us an opportunity to, again, tell the story of the automotive industry, the men and women and the businesses and suppliers that make this happen. And that's, you know, really what we're all about. Mm-hmm. So we said, okay, we'll do it again. And then that, you know, kind of prolonged the moving process once again. But It was really cool because the building got more coverage, you know, raised awareness of what we're doing, bringing back manufacturing downtown and getting to play with these cars and have a good time and what drives us. So
right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the show did fantastic for you guys. It really, you know, put your name on the map as far as what you do. And, I mean, the things that you guys can create at Mopsteel are absolutely fantastic. Me, myself, I'm a huge Packard fan. So with, you know, seeing what you guys did with the patina Packard on the first season of Mopsteel and then going to the actual Packard plant, you know, that was something that's something I've always wanted to see, and to be able to see it on TV and the little tour and everything, I thought was really, really excellent.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun sharing that with everybody across the country because, you know, let's face it, there's a lot of talented car builders all over the world. And there's a lot of great car culture all over the world, and especially in the U.S. So, you know, when we started into this thing, it was, you know, Chip Foose and the Boyd Coddingtons and, you know, Troy Trepanier and all these guys. And you know, they're very talented people. They're not in Detroit. Mm-hmm. So that was always our thing, was like, you know, there's a lot of talented people around here, a lot of great cars. I mean, it's so big. It's just bigger than life coming out of Detroit in this area that we wanted to share that. So, you know, we build some fun stuff. We build some nice stuff. But, you know, let's not get it wrong. I mean, there's guys in their garage around here that build way nicer stuff than we can. So it's a continually humbling experience. So it drives you to be better at what you're doing and be creative and do something different. And, you know, to be able to take and restore a Packard and visit the plant, or to decide to outfit a car with a brand new Roush motor and be able to go to Roush and celebrate companies like that, that's very unique to this area.
Yeah.
We have manufacturing and supply chain on a whole nother level. And I really realized that when I started to travel around and meet all these other car builders and work with them, or even just when we pursued manufacturing the wheels, a lot of aftermarket stuff is done in California, a lot of great companies out there, but on the scale that we do it here, it just doesn't compare. So it was kind of interesting, you know, to come back here and let people get a glimpse on how we operate and why we're so car crazy and why we grow up with this in our blood and why it's really the only thing that matters to us when it comes to a hobby.
Mm-hmm.
So it was fun to share that. And, you know, the show was really successful. Our numbers were awesome. And I think they did a great job. Hoff Productions did a great job doing the show. It was done very well. You know, a car show is a car show. It has the same elements as everybody else. So we had built a great brand before the TV show and a big fan base. And one of the things we were concerned about was tarnishing that because TV sometimes, you know, can portray somebody in a different light because of budgets and stuff like that. It's just what they have to work with.
Yeah. Drama.
Or ratings. Yeah. And we don't have a lot of drama. We're very fortunate to do what we do. We really are. And I don't take for granted every day that I get to wake up, go into my, you know, Albert Kahn building, play with cars, watch wheels being built, interact with customers, meet fans, work with great suppliers, great people. You know, it's unbelievable experience. So every day I'm grateful for that. So I never didn't want that to come across in the show that by any stretch of the imagination where we, you know, didn't appreciate what we had going on, because it's pretty rare that, one, you get to survive in this business, and then it's very rare that, you know, you have people take interest and want to put you on TV. And you know what? If it helps draw light to this area, helps inspire some younger people to let them know that, you know, you can really honestly do anything you want in this country. You know, Mopsteel is proof of that.
You know, you mentioned, especially growing up in Detroit, you know, the love of cars being in your blood. When did you realize that, you know, you had a talent for customizing and modifying cars? And where did all that kind of start for you?
You know, I didn't really know. There wasn't like a certain day or time that it hit me like, wow, I'm really into cars, or I want to change these things. It was just I remember my grandfather had a 65 Lincoln Continental in his barn. He had a Ford Lincoln Mercury dealership. And he had a lot of other really cool vehicles in that barn. And one of them was a Bronco and, you know, these other cars and a special edition stepside truck. But I always played in that Lincoln and I loved it. And I got to a point where I was actually, when the mini truck craze started, I was actually taking ads or magazine, you know, photographs of this old Lincoln. And I would actually like take an X-Acto knife and I'd carve around the wheel wells and I would lower it back down over the tires and I would scotch tape it back together and I'd put it on the fridge. So, you know, it was like I dreamed of modifying these big old cars.
Yeah.
One, before it was really popular. Two, before these cars caught on. Because even when we started working on these big, I call it big Detroit steel, because I love these big body cars.
Yeah.
It makes a statement of the time period and the power of the automotive industry and the opulence and the chrome. And it's just amazing. When I started building the Lincoln Continentals, people thought they were like old man cars, you know? You bag a Cadillac or Lincoln, you know, people called them cataracts and, you know, Sunday drivers, you know. But so it wasn't very popular at all, but I just loved it. I don't really know. I can't put my thumb on it, but I just had a passion for these big, huge cars. And, you know, it's just their design and, you know, just what they accomplished back in the day. In terms of technology and stuff and how the tops work and all the relays.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it makes them a nightmare to work on now, but you know, it really is pretty cool that people could build that level and that high of a design and execute it that well back in the 60s.
Well, I think, you know, even when you look at cars back then and you compare them to now, like if you see an old car going down the road and you look at it right next to a new car, there's just no comparison in style and class and a statement that they were really trying to make with those vehicles compared to now. I think that's something that's really missing from the look of today's, you know, average everyday automobile.
Yeah, I think we have a large chunk of vehicles now that are being designed and built obviously to reach the masses and reach the numbers. You know, it's one of the things that the big three or any other automotive company, I talk about the big three a lot because I'm kind of partial. But one of the things they have to do as a business is they have to try to balance that and hit that middle road, and they're going for numbers and stuff. So on some of the models, you see them really stepping out and taking chances. And some of those have been very, very successful. So those cars are really exciting. But back in the day, like you said, it was just like a wide open, wild, you know, time when that's what drove, you know, the industry was just like new and exciting and different. You know, it was crazy. People would flock to the dealerships on a Saturday to see the new cars unveiled. And, you know, it was always a major, major deal. It wasn't like a couple design cues changed. It was a whole new car. So we see a lot of that go away. And we have platforms now. And, again, we're trying to appeal to the masses because, more people are driving cars than ever. They sell more units than ever. But, you know, there is some exciting stuff going on. I mean – we can buy 860 horsepower cars right off the shoulder floor.
That's nice. That's never been heard of before, but it's nice.
I remember when I was younger, Suzuki came out with a motorcycle that did 203 miles an hour. And that was
that's crazy.
Instantly that was the Hayabusa, and instantly it was regulated. You know, the next year the government stepped in and said, listen, we can't have this happening. Nobody needs to go 200. Flash forward to 2015, we have a Charger Hellcat that does 203. You know,
yeah.
It just blows me away. Even though I know the technology is here, you know, we have a lot of inside track with these guys. We know what's coming next. It's still just it's incredible what some of the automotive companies are doing now in this muscle car horsepower race, the technology race. Even the EVs, the electric plug-in vehicles, with what Tesla has brought to the table in terms of durability and, you know, the autonomous vehicle stuff. This is really amazing technology. The fact that we have as many deaths as we do on the highways now because we're distracted by technology, you know, the automotive industries are adapting to that. They're saying, hey, listen, we're going to make these cars stop themselves and turn and brake and steer. And, you know, we're going to help keep you guys alive. So they're constantly faced, you know, with new challenges. And it's amazing to see what they come up with.
Yeah, I think the way that the future is going with these cars, like you said, with all the stuff that Tesla is doing, it's really out of a science fiction movie. You know, the stuff that they can do. And I was just reading something about how they're trying to make even semi trucks completely autonomous, to where they're just driving themselves, taking freight back and forth. But then they're getting the pushback from the actual trucking industry, like, well, hey, that's our jobs. Yeah. You know, that's the catch 22 there. It's if okay, we can make this autonomous and safe, but then at the same time all these people are now out of work, so where do we find the balance with that type
of thing? There's, you know, change is always a scary thing.
Yeah.
Even as a business owner, you know, when I look at where things are going, and I'm not a young guy anymore, you know, I'm in my formidable years, they call it, in your 40s, and this is where you're, you know, in your stride. But it's also threatening because you know, I have younger kids, and you know, they really have a grasp on this technology and how that's going to apply to them and what they want to see in their vehicles and all this. Well, you know, I almost have to constantly educate myself on what's going on with the younger generation because our audience is changing fast. And I saw an interesting thing. I was at a SAA Ignite event or Ignite thing and did some speaking there. But I got to listen to a lot of the speakers. And one person put up these interesting slides. It had a picture of essentially downtown with all these horses on it, and it had one car. So he circles the one car. And then it shows a picture of the same street, all these cars, and he circles one horse and carriage.
Mm-hmm.
And very similar with what's going to happen with electric vehicles. So I think he's onto something. I mean, these are trends that, you know, we think, you know, okay, well, is this the future? Isn't this the future? And there's only one, you know. You spot a Tesla from a mile away,
yeah,
or a Volt, or, you know, like one of my favorites was the Cadillac. You know, they didn't, you know, nobody wanted a $90,000 electric vehicle, so it went away really fast. But, you know, I think those Evoques and stuff like that are really cool. And you can spot them a mile away because there's just not that many of them.
Right.
But I would beg to gamble that in 15 or 20 years, there'll be a mass amount of them on the road. So as a business owner, I got to figure out what does that mean for us?
You know, right, right.
You know, what does that mean for the next generation of car customizers? You know, who knows? I don't know. I mean, I don't even know what to do with these things besides, you know, enjoy them for what they are and marvel at them.
Yeah, I mean, times are definitely changing, man. That's for sure. And I'm excited but scared to see where it goes, honestly,
yeah.
Really.
Yeah, I do like the 1,100 foot-pounds of torque thing. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. you were mentioning you were doing some public speaking. Is my information correct that you're doing some speaking at FabTech this year?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah? Man. Let's talk about that.
Oh, I'm super excited about that. All these opportunities just validate what we've done as a business.
Mm-hmm.
And that's important to me because I really didn't know what we were doing. You know, we started a business in a really difficult time in the economy. Our industry, there's a lot of critics, and it's very hard to be successful. A business has come and go on a mass scale. So, you know, we were just doing it because we enjoyed it. We liked creating, fabricating, you know, no matter what it was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we made some money doing furniture and outfitting galleries and whatever we could do just to make a buck to buy a plasma cutter, to buy a hoist and pursue our automotive passion, you know, restoring these classic cars. But, you know, the fact that we've got it to this point where now we've built cars, tough way to make a living, we struggled forever, created a brand, got a fan base, eventually we launch a wheel business, start actually making parts that supplies our car building habit. So that kind of eased the tension a little bit. We hired some people. We're putting our actions where our mouth was. You know, we believe in making things in the U.S. We believe in making things here. I truly believe that manufacturing here is very, very important.
Absolutely.
I wasn't going to wait for somebody to ask me to make a part here in the U.S. or in Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
I feel it's our duty as a small business, as it was back in the day, to do it, you know, to execute it. Don't wait around. You know, we need to initiate this change. And when we did that with Detroit Steel Wheel Company, we were really stepping out on an edge. We took a major risk because there really was no means of manufacturing here. So our real challenge didn't come in, can we make a quality product? Can we meet a certain price point? Do we have buyers? Is it the right timing? That had nothing to do with it. The real challenge ended up being, can I even make this here? And that really, to me, was disturbing because I remember when everything was made here. I grew up in that time period. I grew up in a time period where anybody could open a business and be successful overnight and supply the automotive industry, and the demand was insane. And
that was the goal.
Yeah.
That was the goal.
Yeah, and that's what built real wealth. So for a guy like me who doesn't dive too deep into analytics or whatever, I don't overanalyze anything. I'm not a highly intelligent scholar. I look at things very simply, and I looked at the industry saying, wow, the real wealth is gone. So I could go overseas and make this wheel, and I probably would make more money. But here's the problem. All the money that I spend making that product, it's not here. Okay, even though I may put a little more money in my pocket, those actions are actions of a company that says, I need to increase my, you know, net a little bit or my margin a little bit, changes my stock price, then I can borrow money at 0.2% less, whatever. Mm-hmm. That's what we fell into in the 90s. So we just basically rewound and we just thought of everything as it was in the old days, as my grandfather would have. You know what I mean? Let's keep that wealth here in the community.
Went back to
basics. It's going
to
be hard work. It's going to be a lot of sweat equity. We may not get rich from it, but we're doing the right thing. You know, Ford used to talk about how his goal was always to make the highest quality product at the cheapest price for his customer, paying the highest wages possible. And that's a great formula for a healthy business, but we got away from that. So, you know, my goal is always one, relationships, whether it's my employees, fans, or anything. That's the most important thing to me. So I try to treat my employees – I mean, this is my team. Mm-hmm. They are my assets. Through the process of trying to manufacture a wheel here, realizing there's no machinery left, realizing our assets were the guys that used to work in this industry, and now they're old and retired, you know, I realized the machines can be replaced. We can move back into great buildings like the one we got at 2121 there, and we can rebuild all that stuff. Our assets are the people, and this city is full of them. I mean, there is so many people that are just a wealth of knowledge and information and have been there, and so we have everything we need to return this industry to grandeur and manufacture things here. And realistically, that wealth is shared with the rest of this country. And mm-hmm. they felt that when the automotive industry went down. So we saw that happening in 99, 2000, 2001. Well, the rest of the country, all of a sudden in 07, 08, it, you know, it's just like a wave. It went across the country and it hit everybody. So I think it's been down for so long that this next generation is really disconnected with how important it really is to make things here. So and go out and get a skill trade. So, you know, we're trying to send that message by leading by example. Am I going to make a big change? No, absolutely not. You know, my company's small. I got 12 people. We do very well, and we're hoping to expand. But, you know, this needs to be done on a massive level. So I'm just hoping, you know, who knows? You know, maybe other people follow suit. Maybe other people see that there is success in that plan and that approach. And we've had a lot of it. So, you know, we've enjoyed the fact that we just did this because we felt it was right. And everything else just fell into place. You know, it was really an incredible experience.
You know, that's really – go ahead.
We actually talked about this before when we were at TEDx. And so how do you combat that? Like, how do you deal with that? You have the older generation that's retired and not necessarily wanting to dive back in, and getting that younger generation engaged when there's no VOTEC in the schools anymore. There's no – I was floored when my nephew said there's no shop class anymore. Mm-hmm. I was Anthony Michael Hall trying to make the F an elephant, you know, that, and it wouldn't let him in. I went through shop class. I mean, it's – how do you combat that? Like how do you reach out to that next generation and show them this is a cool, good, solid, stable career to get into?
Well, hopefully, again, through – like we were talking about with this fab tech opportunity – you know, all that leads back to that. If I can lead by example, have some success in terms of the media and stuff like that, and a spotlight shined on it, that gives me the opportunity to go to places like FabTech. Not only does it validate what we're doing, but now we can send the message and say, you know, what we're doing is important. A lot of other businesses need to act and behave this way. It's really up to us. It's not up to the customer. Let's let the customer know that, you know, we can make great products here and they can be done at the right price point and the right quality. And so it gives me the opportunity, that audience, like being here, gives me that opportunity to send that message. So we take that message, we package it up really nicely in a podcast or in a video or whatever. We get to speak to – I spoke to 300 Detroit area school kids. We spoke to the 1,200 at TEDx. We've done some days with the Voc Ed schools, even out in Lansing. We're working with Autodyne Grand Rapids on their recruitment side and discussing how important skill trades are. And that's and then we get to send that message at FabTech, but we get to send it to the actual manufacturers of this machinery and the technology and say, hey, this stuff's great. Not only do we need to teach the kids how to use this stuff, but we have to teach them how to use their hands again. And the easy message for us to send – and we even did a thing at the Hispanic Youth Center on Saturday during Dream Cruise. So we had some cars down there. They have a fantastic program where they're putting through tons of kids. And the people getting involved are people from GM, Ford, Chrysler, because they realize they don't have a pool of people to choose from. So now they're going to places like the Youth Center and you know, these Voc Ed schools, and they're recruiting. And they're even coming up with their own programs and plans like Autodye is, where – they are coming up with these programs where they start to teach these kids some trades. They give them the education. you know, and they have a job. What the money they can make is incredible. And the fact that this next generation, when I got out of school, I went to school and, you know, hey, I had the same goals everybody else did. I'm like, you know, I was a product of the 90s. I'm going to get out and make a ton of money. I'm going to have a, you know, I'm going to be Don Johnson with a huge cigarette boat and, you know, all the whole works. And when I got out, the economy was shot. You know, there was no jobs. Now I found myself with a degree that took me a long time to get. I should have been a doctor, but I wasn't. And so now I'm out here in a workforce that's not hiring. So that was tough. Well, now it's an easy solution. Go get a bachelor's or master's degree and be in that position where you're trying to find a $30,000 a year job with $60,000-$70,000 in school debt. Or you can learn how – you can learn a trade, work with your hands, and you can go out and kill it. Yep. Because you have no competition. So you literally can decide what's your motive. Mm-hmm. Do you want to make money? Do you want to be in a certain field? Do you want to be at a certain company? You can write your own journey. It's as easy as that. There is nobody. So how reassuring would that be for somebody to say, hey, look, do you like welding? Well, I don't know. Well, try it, because when you get out, you can get hired literally anywhere you want. You can make $25-$30 an hour. You know, you have no competition. There's not going to be another resume sitting next year's.
I say, or you could be one of 10,000 applicants for another job with
it's
with
crazy.
A pile of student debt.
Right.
Yeah.
So to me, just like Mob Steel looked at the economy that we entered in as a business, we looked at that as an opportunity, not as, you know, something that was difficult or a travesty. It was an opportunity for us.
Yeah.
It was, you know, literally people are just going out of business. We had the ability to acquire some great machinery at a great cost. You know, we acquired some great people. You know, so it really was the reason why Mob Steel is where it's at today. So I think it's really how you look at it. You know, it's the old glass is half full thing.
Yeah.
You know, we got told over and over again, you know, go to school, don't work with your hands, be the guy at the cubicle, whatever. You know what I mean? That's it's not always the best message.
Yeah.
Because not everybody is meant to be, you know, I couldn't do it. I mean, I have the knack for managing people because I spent my life growing up in a shop and working my way from the bottom to the top. So I understand what they're going through very, very well. But if I went to school, I've never been in a shop, got out of school and went into some middle management or, you know, some sort of position like that because I was degreed for it. I think there's a disconnect there.
Yeah, you know what the book says you should know.
Exactly.
Not necessarily how it works in the real world.
I've learned 99, and not to discount anything I've learned in school because I've had some great teachers. And I think that has a lot to do with your ability, like your critical thinking, you know, really is developed in the classroom and stuff. But man, the hands-on stuff and really relational and, you know, politics in the workplace and, you know, all that stuff.
You
learn that on the job.
Yeah, not in school. Yeah. The school can't teach that.
Well, it's theoretical versus practical knowledge. I mean, you can't get practical knowledge out of a book. You can't.
No.
Right.
And the coolest thing too, I was telling somebody, and I'll drift around. I know.
No, yeah,
you hit
it's
that
all good.
Fab tech thing. I'm notorious for just running off at the mouth. So
no, that's okay.
I'm glad this is a 4-hour show. So, because I'm just going to talk, and you guys can listen.
No, it's okay.
where is that? Oh, one of the things I was talking to this young kid came in our showroom, and I've known his family for a while. They're in the car show business. Great family. And their son had the opportunity to kind of go and do some like work shadowing things from school. And he went to a machine shop and he's like, you know, I sat in front of the CNC machine and I didn't like it. It's not for me. And one thing that struck me was like, well, I remember when I started out in the shop and there was a lot of jobs that I didn't like. But the cool part is if you learn how to start at the bottom and you learn how to run that lathe and the knee mill and then you learn how to run the CNC and then you work your way up. You know, whether it's through quality, whether it's through engineering and drawing and everything, that's the one thing that makes you the man. It makes you irreplaceable in that workplace or in that industry or whatever you're doing is you understand that process from beginning to end because you started at the end. You know what I mean? And that's some of the most valuable people I've ever met in my life. So I told him, I said, listen, that may not be the thing you want to do the rest of your life, but look upstream. Start there and learn that and then learn the job ahead of that and ahead of that and ahead of that. Because if you're the guy someday that's doing the engineered drawings and turning that into the math data or creating, you know, your surfaces, your cut paths, whatever, and delivering it to the machine. If you understand both of those very well, you really become a critical part of the component because you know that I don't have to do the drawing here. I can change my tool offsets a little bit here because I need to make a change. You can cheat between the two. It just makes you a wealth of information. You know what that guy needs downstream. You know, I think we came into a position where I want to be the guy that just does the drawings. I go to school. I come out and I don't know anything from there down. I understand it, but I haven't done it. So there's a lot of disconnect between, you know, this guy to this guy's position. So
there's that a constant battle between the guy on the floor and the engineer.
Yeah.
Because the guy on the engineer can design it, but the guy on the floor can build it.
Yeah.
And then there's that disconnect there where this is what's practical versus, you know, like you were saying earlier. Exactly.
And here's where that old school mentality of thinking and, you know, comes in.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody paid their dues. You know, and my grandfather used to tell me this stuff all the time. He's like, you know, you got to pay your dues and work hard enough and it'll pay off. And you hear these things
all the
over and over.
You laughed about.
Yeah, you're like, okay, whatever. To me, it was like when my parents said, stop your crying or I'll give you something to cry about. And I'm like, well, that's ludicrous because I'm already crying.
Right.
So obviously you already gave me something.
Bring it on, Mom.
Yeah. So all that stuff is true. You know, those guys started in the plants. You know, I had a grandfather that started in the steel mill and worked his way up. And, you know, he didn't start out in the Penobscot building with an office being a metallurgist.
Mm-hmm.
That's not where he started. He didn't start as a business owner. He started in the shop. You know, he was a rebel rouser and was running steel out of the back during the strikes and stuff. I mean, you know, they all paid their dues and they became brilliant people and great leaders. And, you know, I'm not saying that is due for every position, but man, when you're in manufacturing, I think there's some value in starting out on them lower jobs and working your way up and paying your dues. And, you know, people have a lot more respect for you. And if you're going to be a boss or a manager or something someday, you understand what it takes to get that job done. None of it's foreign to you. And you're never in a position where, you know, hey, my guys can do everything. So if somebody doesn't show up, no big deal. We just jump in and do it.
Mm-hmm.
As well as when I was working for somebody else, I never asked anybody to do something I didn't know how to do it. I didn't tell them how to do it unless I knew how to do it myself. And if you didn't like it and walked out, I'd do it myself. You know, and everybody else would turn around and look and go, oh, wow. You know, he's running the CNC or, you know, he's running the wash line or he's sorting trucks outside in the 20-degree weather. I wasn't afraid of it because I've done it. So I think there's some value in that, especially when it comes to making things in manufacturing or being in the skill trade.
I mean, that's true regardless. You know, we've talked about, you know, how these lessons apply across industry. The IT industry is the same way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can't tell you at least once every other month I wind up having a conversation with some kid who shows up at our events, you know, who's got his degree. He's all fired up. He's ready for that $100,000 a year job. I'm like, oh, Skippy, that's not how this is going to work out for you.
Yeah.
No, you're going to make 30 and you're going to be on a help desk and you're going to learn and you're going to pay your – that's how this works. Yep.
You're like, can you take back that new leased vehicle?
Right.
Still time? Yeah. You're having trouble making that payment, son.
But it is. I mean, that whole concept of paying your dues is something that I think a lot of industries have lost.
Yes.
That mindset.
To me, I feel like it's being circumvented. And, you know, we paid our dues. Not to say that if somebody hasn't, they can't be a talented at what they do. I just think it applies to certain things. I think it applies to the skill trade and – I think it's just really good seasoning, you know.
Hey, man, I don't want mine to be the first brain that God forbid something happens. I don't want mine to be the first one the brain surgeon cracks open.
No.
I don't, you know, I think it applies pretty much universally.
Absolutely.
You know, but like what you were saying earlier, you know, in the welding industry where I'm at, like you get guys that come right out of school, be it whatever, you know, welding school they go to, and I can weld anything, you know, and it's like, okay, well, you know, you might be able to pass that test, but now try to do that exact same weld, crawling 12 feet inside this tube, laying on your back. There's all kinds of different factors. Like the school might make you a great test taker, but then what do you do when you get out into the actual field? It's quite different.
Yeah, it takes a lot of hood time when you have a buddy working your foot pedal on your TIG 20 feet away.
And the communication between you two,
That's a whole different ballgame.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree with you. And in reverse too. You know, in my case, I learned how to weld when I was really little and I'm not some crazy, you know, I can do it. I lay down a good weld. Structurally, it's great, all this stuff. But I got to a point in my career where all of a sudden I got these machines and I'm like, well, hang on a second. What is this? Like, how does this work? And I had to educate myself on how some of these new machines work because I worked on dinosaurs. I did everything by ear and all the stuff. And now all of a sudden I got a machine that's a computer and I can, you know, set freaks and cleaning and my heat control and my square waves. And I'm like, what the heck? You know,
yeah,
why isn't this thing working?
You know?
So I think it's really cool to share that side and the side you're talking about too, because man, it takes both. I mean, you have to be nowadays to do anything, whether you're welding, fabricating, these new brakes, these new machines, all of this stuff, the 5X laser, everything that we use to fabricate now, you not only need to be highly intelligent and, you know, and skilled in the technical side of the stuff, but you have to be able to know, understand it hands on, like you said. You know, do you need to back gas that or not? You know, am I using the right cup? And, you know, is my, you know, all that stuff. I mean, that stuff changes right on the floor.
Absolutely.
You don't learn that in school.
Yep.
Very cool.
Yep. So let's go back into Mob Steel a little bit. What was there ever a point when because you got Detroit, the wheel company, and you have Mob Steel. Mm-hmm. Was there ever a point when you were doing this where you were like, I don't know if this is going to work, man. Like you got it. You got it all on the line.
Yeah. This morning. Yeah. Let me tell you, I have to remind myself every day. And I tell my guys this and stuff like that because, listen, we make mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if what I'm doing is right. All I can use is different signposts.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a wealthy man. I'm wealthy in life and I'm wealthy in the journey. So I constantly use different measurables in my business. I couldn't use my bank account because that is the worst example. I'm the worst example of a business owner if you looked at my checking account. I have made and spent more money than you can imagine that I ever thought I would.
Mm-hmm.
You know, stabilizing cash flow and all this stuff and blah, blah, blah. So I used measurables like where was I last year? Who was the company I was keeping? Who were we working with? What kind of cars were we building? Where were we at? I use all these other ones because if I looked at my bank account, frankly, I would be like my wife who a lot of the times was at tears at my desk asking me how we're going to buy groceries for my kids.
Yeah.
And even when we started having success in Mob Steel and we launched the wheel business, you know, she was questioning me, you know, who's going to buy this stuff? You know, because she just couldn't see it. And I'm like, man, trust me. I know this is what I want. I have a feeling that this is what, you know, I have a feeling that my brand's at a point now where I can dictate what's next. I can set that trend because I really, truly think this is an awesome wheel. This belongs on these old cars. I just knew it in my heart. But it's not like I had all that worked out on paper.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm running and gunning, man. I'm a shop kid. You know, I'm not some genius that is going to be next in line to run Uber. You know,
the market analytics.
I no joke had friends who were very successful going, dude, what are you doing? Why would you do that? And they're telling me, you know, like that's a terrible decision. I'm like, nah, I don't care. So I had to remind myself, and I still do to today, that listen, I'm going to make the best decision I can
mm-hmm.
with all the information I have. And at that point in time, I set it behind me. It's done. And I go on to the next one and I make that next decision. And I just do the best I can, and I set it behind me. With all the information I had, I made the best decision I could with all the input I got from everybody and everything, and I just set it behind me. And a lot of them are wrong, you know, and a lot of them cost me a bunch of money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we think we're doing okay, and, you know, boom, that was a mistake, and boom, that was a mistake. But when I look at my measurables, we've always moved onward and upward, and that money's moved onward and upward with it. So I'm not afraid whether it's spending $1,600 on a hoist and having to really think about that for a day with my wife whether we're going to get into this business or not, or I'm dropping $1 million on tooling.
Mm-hmm.
I just go for it because I feel in my heart that's what I want to do. It excites me. I get in there. And again, everything's just kind of falling in line. And not to say those are blind decisions, but who knows if they were the best decisions. You know, I question them all the time, but I just have to remind myself, you know, I can't question what I'm doing. I made this decision. A lot of people question, why would you move into a vertical, you know, operations like you're in? Why would you move into an old building downtown that doesn't make any sense? That's, you know, it's an old way of thinking. But you know what? I like that. Mm-hmm. I like the nostalgic of it. I love the nostalgia of the building, and it really stands for what we're all about and the resurgence of manufacturing. And it just makes me feel good. Do you make a business decision off of it makes you feel good? Probably not. But you know what? It's became a destination for everybody. So there was a byproduct of it that we didn't really anticipate. You know, we have people flooding in from all over the country every day to come see it. And it's really cool. And we've actually, you know, it's almost altered some of my business plan. You know, just a foolish decision just because I wanted to do it because I liked it, you know, has now turned into, you know, this is a destination. We may turn that first floor into more of a venue where there's clinics and we're doing stuff with kids. And we're doing stuff with some of the big suppliers and the big three, and we're talking about making it more of a venue where, you know, people can come in and learn from Ron or learn from the, some of these techs at Exalta or SADA or 3M or whatever, these relationships we've created. So that may even change that business plan a little bit and start, you know, filling some of those foolish holes that we use the space for our car building habits, and it may, you know, may be able to share the Mob Steel experience with everybody and bring them in. And so, you know, I don't really know. A lot of it, I really question what I'm doing every day. But the only thing I don't question is how much fun I'm having. Hell, I mean, yeah. I really, truly am living the dream. And as long as I'm enjoying what I'm doing and my people at the shop are enjoying what we're doing, and, you know, we are still moving in the direction of providing a better life for ourselves, a better life for the people around us, we're still becoming stronger and stronger buyers, whether it's our steel supplier or the person we get our tires from down in North Carolina or whatever. That is exciting and rewarding. I don't even look at the bank account anymore. I just, you know, when one of your suppliers turns around and tells you that, you know, when you're like, well, who's your biggest customer? And I'm not trying to have him call me out. I literally am asking that question. They go, and they look at me like, they go, well, you are. Like, you know, what are you talking about? And I'm like, what? And I wasn't trying to stroke my ego.
Right.
I really thought it was somebody else. You know, I thought there would be a top 10 in that fall. But, to, you know, that's pretty cool, you know, to do that and have that effect domestically.
Yeah.
It's a lot of fun, man. It's a lot of fun. And, to, you know, to put yourself in a position where, you know, you have to create new technology here to keep up with the demand you've created. That is pretty cool. You know, so it's those things that – help me, you know, be sane with some of these decisions I'm making. Because if you would have followed me for the last 12, you know, it's 14 going on 15 years now. But, man, that first 12 years, dude, it was rocky. Mm-hmm. It was scary. I always got my people paid, but barely a lot of times. I mean, I used to go home with notes on the door. You know, we're going to lose the house. I'm having meetings with the bank. And
yep.
I've been through all of that. And you know what? You know, I really actually enjoyed that time, and I still enjoy the tough times because that's what all of America went through. I mean, you know, 70 million Americans went through tough financial times and lost everything they had. And even though I didn't lose everything I had, I fought like heck to keep it. And it built a lot of character and toughness. And just like the SEMA projects or the building a car every 3 weeks on the show with five people on the team and, you know, all of those challenges that are unsurmountable really have made Mob Steel who it is. You know, that's Mob Steel's DNA. Mm-hmm. Was all that character building. So I wouldn't trade it for the world. But now, you know, we've got a great business going with the wheel business, and the demand's high. But that doesn't mean it can't all go away tomorrow. I mean, listen, we're operating in the aftermarket industry. It's full of trends and fads, and you know, if you're not staying ahead of that curve and you're not being innovative and you're not the next thing, you're gone. Mm-hmm. So. You know, it happens. I'm 42 years old. There's going to be a certain point in time in my life where me or somebody in my business doesn't have our thumb on what's next.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll be the next guy. You know, so I'm prepared for that day, whether it's tomorrow or 10 years from now. I was good with it and I enjoyed everything we did. So that's just – it's all mindset at that point.
I don't think there's a better way that we could close this interview, honestly. that was pretty awesome. But before I let you go, where are you going to be? I know you said you have FabTech coming up in November. You're going to be speaking there. Yeah. Is there any other appearances you're going to be doing or anything?
Absolutely. We will be at obviously at SEMA.
Mm-hmm.
We're battling the SEMA crunch like everybody else. We wouldn't miss it. We weren't going to do something, but we are working with Roush this year. We got a great drivetrain. We're putting in a 68 Lincoln Continental. That'll be at their show hall or outside. And it'll give us a lot of time to hang out there and meet with people. We also have obviously a schedule there. So if you look up, follow our social media, you can see our schedule. We race from one booth to another now. It's a very surreal experience. I mean, we're walking into SEMA. We're launching – last year we launched our color line with Exalta, so we have a Mob Steel signature color line.
Very cool.
Which is completely crazy because, again, I would have never anticipated it coming to this point. You dream of it, but you can't fathom like these things happening. So We will be in the Exalta booth. We have a sketch battle, which is really cool. So there's a Middlecott sketch battle happens downtown Detroit here, and they've franchised it now to L.A. I work with Brooke, who puts on the sketch battle, him and his partner. And they bring in Ralph Giles and all these great designers and all the next talent, you know, like your Darby Barbers and all these young kids are just insane. Insanely talented designers, and they have basically this like throwdown party sketch battle, and they have themes, and they have three rounds, and they compete, and it's such a great experience. Well, this year we have this cool opportunity that they're doing a Mob Steel themed sketch battle in Vegas during SEMA. So we're going to have a Wednesday night event where it's this Mob Steel themed sketch battle. We're going to have all the next great talents come in and design these three cars based around, you know, some certain criteria. So we have that going on. Again, the Exalta stuff. I will be with AC Delco. I do spokesperson work for AC Delco, a byproduct of the fan base and the success of Mob Steel, which, again, very validating, very cool. We've got to make some really cool commercials with them. We just did a Restore and Ride Challenge up in Toronto with some editors and just some really neat stuff. So we'll be at Apex making an appearance there. But just kind of check our social media. You can see where we're at. We just have a great time meeting everybody out there. We fly back, go directly to FabTech. We're speaking at FabTech, doing a keynote there. It's a whole thing that I never thought I would be doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I started you know, hitting stuff with a hammer and welding and,
yeah.
You know, yeah, I wouldn't have told you like, oh, yeah, I'm going to go speak at these events and I'll do TEDx and, you know, be on TV and all this. So it's really just, you know, that's kind of a really cool part of the adventure.
Yeah.
It's part of it that is out of my comfort zone. It really challenges me. I'm a very competitive person, so I like to try to improve every time. And every time, whether I'm speaking to 30 or 40 people or I'm speaking to 4,000, I still get that rush. You know, it's really wild.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm looking forward to it. It's exciting. I don't know why people want to hear my story, but but I like sharing it. And we've always seemed to have a good response from everybody. And I'm enthusiastic about manufacturing and fabricating stuff. So it shouldn't be too bad.
Right on, man.
Yeah.
Well, very cool. Well, I will thank you very much for your time, and I will see you at FabTech,
man.
Because I will be there, man. So,
oh, no kidding.
Yep, yep,
very
I'm going to be there. It's going to be cool.
Cool, yeah. I appreciate this opportunity.
Hey, anytime, man.
It's very flattering.
And by see you, he means every time you turn around, he'll be right there.
I'll be right there, yes. Yes.
Perfect.
Yes.
Perfect.
I'll be the Mob Steel shadow. Remember me?
I'll just get some Mob Steel gear for you.
That works. I'll run around the whole place.
Perfect. Man, thanks, guys.
All right, very cool, man.
Appreciate it.
Yeah, not a problem.
All right, everybody, thank you so very much for listening. Huge shout out to Dave Phillips from the IT and the D Show for being the sound engineer on this episode. You can check out Adam Janai's FabX Tech Talks from 8:45 to 10 a.m. Monday, November 6th at FabTech at McCormick Place in Chicago. If you like this episode and you want to hear more, go to www.artjunkies.com for a full backlog of episodes. Also, you can subscribe on iTunes, and if you do, please leave an iTunes review as your reviews help our ranking and help the show reach more people. Next week, the road to FabTech continues, but until then, stay safe and weld hard.